Our next case is 2022-0321 in the matter of the State of Ohio versus Leland Miller. On behalf of the appellant, Mr. Parker.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy. May it please members of the court. I am John Parker. I do represent Mr. Miller. I would ask for 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. Your Honors, Mr. Miller is actually innocent of the crimes for which he has been convicted and for which he is incarcerated. His conviction is based on perjured testimony of one key witness. And I use the word key because that's what the prosecutor used in their final arguments. The key and only eyewitness to this murder has come forward many years later and provided a handwritten 3-page affidavit stating that he lied at trial, that he did not see my client with a gun, he did not see my client shoot the victim as he testified to several years earlier. And so with this affidavit, Mr. Miller retained counsel and filed a motion for leave to file a new trial motion under Criminal Rule 33, as well as a petition for post-conviction relief under 2953-21. The trial court denied without any hearing, without any findings, simply in a one-sentence entry, denied Mr. Miller's ability to pursue that relief.
Was there a request for a hearing?
Yes, there was.
And in the state's opposition, what did they say about the credibility of these allegations?
They said the state disagrees with that this affidavit is credible. But it's our position that there are three different violations, at least, under the Ohio Constitution here.
Well, how do you make that determination whether the recantation is credible without having a hearing?
We don't think you can, Your Honor, and that's one of the problems here. And we would point the court towards the U.S. Supreme Court case of Pennsylvania ex rel Herman versus Cloudy, where if there are disputed facts, you resolve that through a hearing. That's the tradition of our courts. The trial court has a witness stand, right? You bring in a witness, you hear what they have to say, and the judge makes credibility determinations. But the affidavit itself is extremely detailed. It's handwritten. Mr. Godfrey, who wrote the affidavit, or signed the affidavit certainly, came forward on his own volition years later. We weren't knocking on his door asking him for this. He came forward because he said he needed to tell the truth. You know, his conscience obviously got to him. He says, I feel deep down I have to come forward and tell the truth. I will testify to this. This is the truth. And so...
So what evidence was submitted that your client was unavoidably prevented from coming forward with this new evidence?
Well, it's the time frame, right? Several years after the murders, this gentleman comes forward. Obviously, if somebody lies, you can't force someone to tell
you. I understand that, but the statute or the rule does require that you show that you are unavoidably prevented.
The fact that this was a lie, that this gentleman says...
So we should just adopt a blanket rule that all recanted testimony, someone's unavoidably prevented from discovering...
Well, it's not simply recanted testimony. He says he lied. And so even though he was subject to cross-examination, of course, at the trial, when someone lies, the fact that they were cross-examined has to be diminished.
Was there anything in his affidavit that dealt with the unavoidably prevented requirement?
Well, I think it's implicit in him saying, I feel deep down I have to come forward, that he hasn't come forward before. He had reached a moment in his life where he couldn't live with himself. Is the way I think is a reasonable way of looking.
Well, but actually, the requirement is for your client to show that he was unavoidably prevented. Is there anything in his submissions that meets that requirement?
I don't know how you can force someone to come forward and admit they were lying. He's incarcerated. He has no power to subpoena. He has no power to take a deposition or anything like that. He can't force someone who's told a lie to tell the truth. The person has to be ready to come forward and tell the truth.
Counsel, the 8th District opinion suggests that after the trial and the verdict came in, that the defendant should have approached during that 120-day period and said, hey, I have a strong feeling that you're lying. Would you be willing to recant? Is that their analysis?
The Eighth District's opinion was before Bethel came out, right? And so Bethel, and I think the Eighth District was looking at this time factor, saying, you know, you need to do something, right?
Yeah. But does Bethel control this case?
Absolutely, it controls this case. It's an intervening decision from this court. We included it in our memorandum in support of jurisdiction. It was timely, right? The appeal was not final yet. The judgment was not final yet. So Bethel does apply. And I think, you know, I don't think this court wants to endorse a position where someone in my client's position is sending a friend, a relative, an investigator, a lawyer, knocking on a witness's door and saying, hi, I'm back. You were lying, weren't you? Okay, I'll be back next week until the whole 120 days or whatever the time frame is. That's just not practical.
Well, when Mr. Godfrey came forth with the revelation that he was lying, when was the petition filed in the court?
He came forward and presented the affidavit to a mutual friend. Mr. Godfrey, my client, directed his son, who had possession of the affidavit, to send that to the Innocence Project in Cincinnati, which he did. It took them, in my client's point of view, a little too long to act upon it. And so then he hired me, quite frankly, to pursue relief if there was any to be had. I received the affidavit from Cincinnati, from the Innocence Project, September, I believe it was, of 2020. And the new trial motion, the post-conviction motion, was filed late October, early November. And what I needed to do, quite frankly, was some investigation to see if the affidavit was genuine. And so I hired an investigator, my client hired an investigator, to talk to the notary and to talk to other people, and we attached additional affidavits to the motion for leave to make sure this was genuine, because I only had a copy at that point. So as soon as I got those affidavits, which was in August, I received the original affidavit in September. We filed late October, early November. That's certainly a reasonable amount of time if you're going to pursue that, approximately a little more than a year after the affidavit was executed. I believe it was executed in July of 19.
So this is obviously, when you look at this, it's a very unusual kind of notary thing going on here. Was Godfrey's, his statement was handwritten, was it sworn under oath?
Good question, Your Honor.
He doesn't say that, does it?
He doesn't swear to use those words. It's not written as an affidavit written by a professional might be written. But what happened was the notary acknowledged the statement. And I'd suggest the court look at a few different things to.
But it's still an unsworn statement, right?
I disagree, Your Honor. It is.
Why?
Because of the word acknowledgment. And you look at Ohio Revised Code 147.541C1, an acknowledgement is deemed accurate for the purposes stated therein. Here it's the truth. He says he wants to come forward and say the truth. If you look at Black's Law Dictionary as to what an acknowledgement is, it's one of the definitions is its testimony, affirmation as to what's in there. Okay? And this is simply a motion for leave to file a new trial motion. Right? So providing this documentation certainly provides prima facie evidence, all right, prima facie evidence that a new trial motion should be allowed.
Okay? Well, does it? I mean, typically we would say that sworn statement, you know, if someone submits a sworn statement that if believed, if you believe the facts, that would state a claim for relief, then you're entitled to a new trial. But I don't know what we do with a situation where someone submits an unsworn statement.
Yeah, I suggest it's not really unsworn because of the acknowledgement provided by the notary. And you look at the revised code section, and you look at Black's Law Dictionary, and you look at the body of case law that says pro se documents are to be liberally construed. And so that's Estelle from the United States Supreme Court. And this is clearly a pro se document. and you have the acknowledgement. I suggest the key here is the notary and the acknowledgement by the notary, that we know it's his signature because he provided photo identification. She saw that. He acknowledged the truth of what he was saying in that statement. That's what acknowledgement means. That's what it means under 147.541 that I cited earlier. That's a definition under Black's Law Dictionary. And so I understand the question, but I suggest that he's presented enough to give him a hearing and to follow through and file the new trial motion itself. And you know, we're arguing actual innocence under the Ohio Constitution. I want to make that very clear. And there are three sections of the Ohio Constitution which apply here. One is due process, both procedural and substantive, that it violates Ohio's due process clause to base a conviction on false testimony. That under the cruel and unusual punishment clause, Article 1, Section 9 of the Ohio Constitution, to have someone incarcerated and convicted on false testimony shocks the sense of justice of the community, and that's why it violates Article 1, Section 9. And then access to the courts, of course, under Article 1, Section 16 of the Ohio Constitution, any person is guaranteed access to the courts for their grievances if they can show they were harmed somehow, right? And so that's what we have here. We have all three. And I also ask the court to look at 2953.21F, the post-conviction statute, where if there are sufficient documentations provided, which can be sworn, but they don't have to be, and they're not contradicted completely by the record, then one is entitled to a hearing. And that's what we
want.
Well,
but wait a second. In this case, it came after 120 days. So your client has to show that both of the requirements of 2953.23A1 are met, right?
Yes.
And so how does your client show a new federal state right that applies retroactively to persons in this petitioner's situation?
Well, this court has never interpreted the Ohio Constitution clearly as we're asking it to, as we're asking. I mean, I couldn't find a case from this court.
Well, says the United States Supreme Court has to recognize a new federal or state right. So how has the United States Supreme Court done that?
It has not.
So then it doesn't meet the requirements of 2953.23, right? So you're not entitled to file.
That was one of our arguments. It's not our only argument, all right? And it's our argument that under the Ohio Constitution, as I said, either under Criminal Rule 33 or under the post-conviction statute. And so, you know, many other state constitutions have held this. I'd ask the court to look at the Iowa case, Schmidt. It's a beautiful opinion about how a person has to have an ability under the state constitution to come in and present their new evidence that they're innocent. So you have Iowa, you have Illinois, you have South Dakota, New York, Connecticut, New Mexico, Texas, Kentucky, and Missouri, at the very least, that recognize freestanding claims to actual innocence. And whether that's under Criminal Rule 33 or under 2953.21 or some other method, there has to be a method for an actually innocent person to present their evidence.
Do we even have to get to that question? I mean, all you are alleging at this point in time is that you have evidence that, if true, would undermine the theory of guilt that was used to convict your client. That's so you want to get back to square one. But the only way to determine that, in my view, is by having a hearing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So we don't even have to recognize an actual innocence claim under these facts.
I'm asking the court to do that because if we go back and have the hearing, what I'm afraid is I'm going to get what I've run into before, is that no Ohio court has recognized under the Ohio Constitution a freestanding claim of actual innocence. Therefore, you lose.
Well, if you go back and have the hearing and this recanting witness comes off as credible and the independent judge agrees that it would undermine the theory of guilt, He's not going to declare your client innocent. He's just going to simply say he deserves a new trial.
He deserves a new trial because the first trial is invalid because it violates due process. It violates the cruel and unusual punishment clause.
But he won't say he's innocent, you're free to go.
Not likely. We'll take a new trial. I mean, we'd love a declaration of innocence, of course, but we're practical people, and we'd certainly take a new trial.
But just like the 8th District, we're appellate court judges. We don't make findings of fact. We don't have a witness stand in here.
That's correct, and that's why we need a hearing, and we're entitled to a hearing. When an innocent person has an affidavit, they have new evidence that they're innocent, that the only witness, there's no physical evidence here, that the only witness who testified against them has voluntarily come forward and lied. I lied. I didn't see this as I testified. What's a person to do? They have to come, they have to have access to the court so they can present their evidence.
So do you think the affidavit and the way that he stated that he lied, that his conscience kind of got to him, assuming that what he said is true, do you think that is clear and convincing proof that your client was unavoidably prevented from discovery of that new evidence?
Yes, because I don't know how else. You know, when someone says they lied, right, how can you force them to tell the truth? They have to be willing to tell the truth. Their conscience has to get to them. And that's what happened here, we suggest. And so it doesn't matter how much time goes by. What's important is that the court gets to the truth and that an innocent person is not incarcerated. Who cares about the time frame, quite frankly? All right? What interest does the state have in incarcerating an innocent person? Whether it's 120 days, 121 days, 4 years, 5 years, who cares? There's no interest, no legitimate interest the state has in keeping an innocent person incarcerated. I'll save my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
There is none.
Mr. Miranda.
Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court, Anthony Miranda. I'm joined by Kristen Hatcher, Assistant Prosecuting Attorneys on behalf of the State of Ohio. I want to respectfully ask this court to dismiss this appeal as improvidently allowed for two reasons. The first is that the propositions of law before the court are not determinative of the outcome in this appeal. And the second is that much of the propositions of law are not preserved or well supported. With respect to the first argument, the 8th District Court of Appeals in this case held that the statement, non-affidavit from the recanting witness was not credible. And that holding has not been appealed by Mr. Miller in this case.
Well, so the Court of Appeals decided in the first instance the credibility?
It indicated in its analysis, and there's a long line of 8th District cases saying for it to be new evidence, the recantation must be credible. And it held.
It decided its credibility before the trial court got to decide its credibility.
Well, the trial court denied the motion summarily, so it didn't specifically address credibility. But the 8th District held as one of the reasons for affirming that decision, it held that the trial court's denial of those motions was proper because the affidavit lacked credibility. There was not compelling information to overcome that presumption against recantations.
How can an appellate court make that determination without holding a hearing, watching the witness testify in direct and cross-examination? How can they do that?
Well, there is no requirement that the trial court hold hearings on every petition.
I agree, but I just don't know how an appellate court judge who hasn't seen the testimony, hasn't viewed the witness under cross-examination, makes that determination on whether it's credible or not.
Well, I think that, again, my first argument would be that I don't think it's before the court, but I think that decision was justified in this case.
Didn't we just say in Blanton that appellate courts shouldn't judge credibility of affidavits?
Your Honor, I don't. In Blanton, you had an issue of ineffective assistance and res judicata.
Well, there was also some discussion about judging the credibility of affidavits in there, I think.
I guess what I would say, Your Honor, is I don't think the 8th District here is judging the credibility of the evidence. What the 8th District is doing is determining whether or not there is new evidence. And that's the analysis.
Wait a second. They're saying it's not new evidence because they're saying it's not credible. So
that's what 8th District.
That's pretty circular, right? I mean, they're judging the credibility. I mean, they're making whether it's new evidence depend on their assessment of whether the evidence is credible.
Because from an evaluation standpoint, if a key witness to the state's case says, I lied about what I testified to, that was clearly in favor of the state and was decided or considered by the trier of fact, how is that not new? No one said before, oh, Mr. Godfrey is lying. And no one proved Mr. Godfrey was lying during the trial. And as Mr. Parker said, no one followed Mr. Godfrey over a period of days or weeks or months to say, hey, weren't you lying? Weren't you lying? So how isn't a recantation of key testimony not new evidence?
So there's a long line of 8th District cases that hold, based on the settled proposition that we should view recantations with suspicion, that if the recantation lacks credibility, that it's not new.
But in this instance, only the Court of Appeals said it lacked credibility. And did the Court of Appeals say how it lacked credibility?
It did, Your Honor. So Mr. Miller testified at trial that he observed, or excuse me, Mr. Godfrey, the witness, testified at trial that he saw Mr. Miller shoot and kill the victim. Mm-hmm. He testified that immediately after that shooting, he called his girlfriend and told her that Lee shot Rich. And his girlfriend testified to that fact at trial under oath. And Mr. Godfrey testified at trial that the following morning, he told his mother that he was in the car when the shooting happened. And she testified at trial under oath. And the state presented cell phone records that corroborated the fact that those two calls happened.
Absolutely. And didn't Mr. Godfrey say, I lied to my sister, I lied to my mother, so that they could support that testimony?
He does say generally that he lied in this unsworn statement, but he fails to really account for the alleged lies of his sister and mother, because at the time he's...
Well, I don't know if the sister and mother knew they were lying, if that's what he told them.
Well, I think that's what the court would have to believe, that if Mr. Miller was lying at trial, then his girlfriend and his mother also lied.
No, not if that's what they're saying, this is what he told us.
But his claim for why he lied at trial is that the police and prosecutors were pressuring him. And that involvement doesn't happen until well after he would have contacted those relatives.
But initially, he said his fear was that they would pin the murder on him. That's what he said in his acknowledged affidavit, whatever it's called.
Yeah, the handwritten statement, Your Honor.
Yes.
He does say that generally, but at other times he acknowledges he didn't know that the victim had died until the following day. I mean, some of the claims, one of the claims in the handwritten statement is he alleges that the trial judge told him at trial what to say and what not to say on the stand.
Okay, I want to look, though, at this question of if the Court of Appeals couldn't make a credibility determination, let's just say it couldn't, the trial court would have to do that. But we just released Hatton December 10th of 2022, State v. Hatton, and essentially we said when a defendant seeks leave to file a motion for a new trial under Criminal Rule 33B, the trial court, in this case it would be the appellate court as well, may not consider the merits of the proposed motion for a new trial until after it grants the motion for leave. So aren't we putting the cart before the horse arguing all of these things? I mean, we really have to look at whether this is clearly and convincingly newly discovered evidence. And I mean, can we focus the argument there?
So with respect, I would say two things. The first is that issue, if the state is wrong or the 8th District is wrong about having the hearing, is really not a proposition before the court. And so I don't think this is the case to decide that question. And then secondly, I don't think any of the court's recent cases overruled this court's decision in Calhoun, which said that the trial court can make credibility determinations in what this court called paper hearings. And it specifically listed factors for the court to consider, including whether or not the new evidence is inconsistent with the trial evidence. The trial judge in this case presided over the trial. He would have observed Mr. Godfrey's sworn testimony. It was well within his discretion to not hold a hearing in this case.
Even though Godfrey is saying something totally different than what the judge heard during the first trial? I mean, let's assume that Godfrey's lying in his unsworn statement, okay? Doesn't the state benefit from conducting a hearing and cross-examining him on all these inconsistencies and finding out the way it was obtained? And in open court at a hearing, his unsworn statement falls apart, then there you go. The conviction has integrity. Doesn't the state benefit from that kind of transparency?
Your Honor, whether the state would benefit, that's a policy question. If this court wants to create a rule that hearings should be held on every post-conviction filing, the court can do that. I just don't think this is the case, one, to do that. And two, I think it's fair to say that would be fairly disruptive upon the system. To have hearings on every post-conviction filing would significantly increase the workload of the lower courts.
Not on every one, only on cases where, as here, they have concrete evidence, true or not true, but if it is true, it would undermine the theory of guilt that was used to convict the defendant.
It would, Your Honor, but I think because of the nature of the state's evidence at trial, the unsworn claim is so lacking in credibility, a hearing was not required.
But wouldn't you want to know which time he was lying? Was he lying at trial, or is he lying now? Why would it hurt to hold a hearing on that?
The analysis this court has engaged in the past doesn't put the burden on the state to identify a harm. I mean, there's obviously resource issues
for a hearing?
From the state's perspective, we're satisfied on the paper record that he's lying now in that recantation. I want to just briefly say a few things about the propositions of law. The first proposition of law relates to this court's decision in Bethel, which deals with the delay a defendant has in pursuing the new evidence after the time periods have run. So 120 days for new trials, 1 year for petitions. The 8th District obviously didn't have the benefit of Bethel, as it decided this case before Bethel came out. But Mr. Miller didn't make the argument that Bethel made in the trial court or the 8th District. His argument was that he exercised reasonable diligence. He never said he didn't need to exercise reasonable diligence. So I think that argument has been forfeited. It's raised for the first time on appeal to this court. And there are forfeited arguments, I think, arguments that are not preserved with respect to his third proposition. He raises the argument that there are freestanding claims of actual innocence within the Ohio Constitution. He cites two clauses. The first is the due course of law clause, but he fails to cite the provision of the Ohio Constitution that contains the due course of law clause in his actual proposition of law. And it's well settled jurisprudence going back to the 1800s that this court treats the due course of law clause as coextensive with the federal due process clause. And this court acknowledged in Apanovich that the federal due process clause contains no such actual innocence claim. I think with respect to the cruel and unusual punishments clause, Mr. Miller fails to really grapple with the underlying merits of that claim. He doesn't make any argument relating to its text, to the history of that clause, to the decades of jurisprudence interpreting it. That clause on its face is talking about punishment fitting crime. It's talking about the proportionality of the sentence. It's not concerned with questions of guilt and innocence, as other trial rights are, like the right to counsel, the right to a jury trial, for instance. And then lastly, I would say, in this particular case, it doesn't matter all that much whether there is an actual innocence claim in the Constitution. If this court agrees with the state that the credibility determination is not before it, then really actual innocence could exist in the Constitution, but it's not available to Mr. Miller. You know, there may be some right to raise that claim, but there isn't a claim here because it's not a credible recantation. So for these reasons, we think the 8th District Court of Appeals' decision should be affirmed. We think many of the, this court should dismiss the case as improvidently allowed, or alternatively should affirm the decision based on its credibility determination. And if the court doesn't have any questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So you're out of time. I'll give you 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honors. This is newly discovered evidence. It's sufficient for all the reasons we stated before to merit a hearing. That's what we're asking for at the very minimum, is a hearing so we can present the evidence we have. There was no physical evidence. There was only this one eyewitness who has now come forward years later to say, I lied. There has to be a remedy for someone in that situation. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll receive a decision from the court. Marshall, would you please recess the court?